This is Lecture 4 in the series Inflation and Price Controls.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'll try to speak as slowly as possible. I understand that I was understood better last time. In Lecture 3, we began our study of the free market by demonstrating that the rate of profit tends toward uniformity in all the different branches of industry. We saw that the operation of this principle underlies the coordination of the different branches of production, the power of the consumers to determine the course of production, and the progressive increase in production. And finally, of course, we applied the principle to some cases of price controls and saw how their repeal would make possible an increase in the production of such badly needed goods as housing in New York City, crude oil, and natural gas. Tonight, we will deal with the following subjects. First, an explanation of why, in a free economy, there are no limits to economic progress. In particular, why the supply of raw materials does not constitute a limitation. Then we will go on to the proof and application of four additional principles of free market economics, all of them similar or closely related to the uniformity of profit principle we developed in Lecture 3. These principles are, 1, in a free market, the same good tends to have the same price throughout the world. 2, the price of a good in the present tends to equal the price it is expected to have in the future. 3, workers of the same degree of ability tend to earn the same wage rates. 4, the prices of products tend to be governed by their costs of production. In the course of tonight's lecture, I will make some further applications to price controls. In particular, I will explain why, if the United States had not had price controls during the Arab oil embargo, the Arabs would not have been able to threaten American oil supplies. Instead, they would only have succeeded in promoting the growth of our oil industry at the expense of their oil industry. And now let us begin. The picture I painted in Lecture 3 of a free economy was one of continuous progress and improvement. And so it has been in the United States over the last 200 years. During most of which time we had a substantially free economy. As the free economy has come to be steadily undermined and the transition to a form of socialism drawn ever closer, however, the foundations of economic progress have been eroded. For reasons that should become clearer with each succeeding lecture from now on, a controlled or socialist economy cannot have economic progress. I believe that the advocates of socialism know this, or at least that they sense it. And as a result, they have launched a widespread campaign to deny the very metaphysical possibility of continuous economic progress. The nature of their attempt is summed up in the phrase, the limits to growth. The motivation of the supporters of that phrase, I believe, is to be able to blame the end of economic progress not on the end of capitalism, but on the metaphysical nature of the world. So let us look for a moment at the metaphysical facts that underlie the possibility of continuous economic progress. As far as man himself is concerned, the basic fact is that knowledge can be transmitted from generation to generation, and that each generation has the ability to add to the total of what it has received. the only limit to this process would be the attainment of omniscience. Let us look at the physical world in which man lives. Is there a limit to the supply of natural resources on Earth? Yes, there is. But the limit is utterly irrelevant to human action. For practical purposes, it is infinite. Because the limit is the entire mass of the Earth. The entire Earth, from the uppermost limits of its atmosphere to its very center, 4,000 miles down, consists exclusively of natural resources, of solidly packed natural resources. Because what is the Earth made out of? It is made exclusively out of chemical elements, found in different combinations and in different proportions in different places. For example, the Earth's core is composed mainly of iron and nickel. Aluminum is found practically everywhere. Even the soil of the Sahara Desert is composed of various compounds of silicon, carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, aluminum, iron, and so on, all of them having who knows what potential uses that science may someday unlock. Nor is there a single element that does not exist in the Earth in millions of times larger quantities than has ever been mined. Now, this limit of natural resources has existed from the very first day that man appeared on Earth. And in all the millennia since, it has not diminished by so much as a single atom. That is because chemical elements are never destroyed. They simply reappear in different compounds, in different proportions, in different places. For example, there is not one atom less of any chemical element in the world today than there was before the Industrial Revolution. The only difference is that instead of lying dormant, out of man's control, the chemical elements have been moved about as never before in such a way as to improve human life. For instance, some part of the world's iron has been moved from the interior of the Earth, where it was useless, to now constitute buildings, bridges, automobiles, and a million and one other things of benefit to human life. Some part of the world's carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen have been separated from certain compounds and recombined in others, in the process releasing energy to heat and light homes, power automobiles and railroad trains, and in countless other ways serve human life. Nor is the world running out of kinetic energy by virtue of the energy released in these ways, because heat from the sun every year provides a constantly renewed supply that is millions of times greater than the energy consumed by man. It follows from these facts that all that has occurred as a result of the Industrial Revolution is that man has improved his environment. Please observe that by its very nature, production means an improvement in the environment. Because all that production of any kind metaphysically consists of is the rearrangement of the same chemical elements that nature gives us, but in ways that make them stand in a more useful relationship to man. Consider further examples. To live, man needs to be able to move his person and his goods from place to place. If an untamed forest stands in his way, such movement is difficult or impossible. It constitutes an improvement in the environment, therefore, when man moves the chemical elements that constitute some of the trees of the forest somewhere else and lays down chemical elements brought from somewhere else to constitute a road. It is an improvement in the environment when man builds bridges, digs canals, opens mines, clears land, constructs houses, or does anything else that represents an improvement in the external material conditions of his life. All economic activity has as its sole purpose the improvement of the environment. That is, it aims exclusively at the improvement of the external material conditions of human life. In trying to restrict man's freedom to improve his living conditions, the misnamed environmental movement seeks to force man to live in a less favorable environment. Now, because the world is composed entirely of natural resources and possesses a virtually irreducible and practically infinite supply of kinetic energy, the problem of natural resources is simply one of being able to obtain access to them, of being able to obtain command over the resources. That is, of being in a position to be able actually to direct them to the service of human well-being. This is strictly a problem of science, technology, and the productivity of labor. Its solution depends merely on learning how to break down and then put together again various chemical compounds in ways that are useful to man, and having the equipment available to do it without requiring an inordinate amount of human labor. Human intelligence certainly has the potential for discovering all the knowledge that is required, and in a free, rational society, the incentive of profit virtually guarantees that this knowledge will both be discovered and provided with the necessary equipment to be put to use. The record of the last two centuries certainly demonstrates that such a society has no problem of a scarcity of accessible natural resources. While the total volume of chemical elements in the world has remained the same, the volume of useful elements and compounds at the disposal of man has been enormously increased. Today, for example, because of improved knowledge and equipment, it is probable that man can more easily extract minerals from a depth of 1,000 feet than he could a century ago from a depth of 50 feet. In the same way, he has learned how to use elements and compounds he previously did not know how to use, such as aluminum and petroleum, which have only been in use for approximately a century, and more recently, uranium. There is no reason why, under the continued existence of a free and rational society, the supply of accessible natural resources should not go on growing as rapidly or even more rapidly than in the past. Further advances in mining technology, for example, that would make it possible to mine economically at a depth of, say, 5,000 feet instead of the present vastly more limited depths, would so increase the portion of the Earth's mass accessible to man that all previous supplies of accessible minerals would appear insignificant by comparison. And even at 5,000 feet, man would still, quite literally, just be scratching the surface, because the radius of the Earth extends to a depth of 4,000 miles. In the same way, equally or even more dramatic advances are possible in the field of energy, such as may occur through the use of atomic energy, hydrogen fusion, solar power, tidal power, or thermal power from the Earth's core, or still other processes as yet unknown. Because the Earth is literally nothing but an immense solid ball of useful elements, and because man's intelligence and initiative in the last two centuries were relatively free to operate and had the incentive to operate, it should not be surprising what the result has been. The result has been that the supply of accessible minerals today vastly exceeds the supply that man is economically capable of exploiting. In virtually every case, there are vast known deposits of minerals which are not worked because it is not necessary to work them. Indeed, if they were worked, there would be an overproduction of minerals and an underproduction of other goods. That is, a waste of capital and labor. In virtually every case, it is necessary to choose which deposits to exploit, namely those which by virtue of their location, amount of digging required, the degree of concentration and purity of the ore, and so forth, can be exploited at the lowest costs. Today, enormous mineral deposits lie untouched, which could be exploited with far less labor per unit of output than was true of the very best deposits exploited perhaps as recently as a generation or two ago, thanks to advances in the state of mining technology and in the quantity, in the quality and quantity of mining equipment available. As just one example, and a very important one, consider the fact that there are petroleum deposits in shale rock and tar sands in our own Rocky Mountain states and in Canada of a size far exceeding the petroleum deposits of the Arab countries. Until now, these deposits have not been exploited because it has been cheaper to obtain petroleum from liquid deposits. Even though oil obtained in these ways would be more expensive than oil obtained in the liquid state, still, it is undoubtedly cheaper in terms of the labor required to produce it to obtain oil in these ways today than it was to obtain liquid petroleum a century ago and probably even a generation or two ago. There is no reason why further advances in mining technology and in the availability of mining equipment would not enable oil obtained in these ways in the future to be less expensive than oil obtained in its liquid state today. Similarly, there are vast untapped known coal fields in the United States containing enough coal to supply present rates of consumption for many centuries. In some important respects, these coal fields must be considered not merely a substitute, but the full equivalent of petroleum deposits, because it is possible to produce some of the identical products from coal as from oil, for example, gasoline. This too has not been done commercially until now, because it has been cheaper to produce gasoline from petroleum. But there is no reason why, with the further progress of technology and the availability of equipment, gasoline produced from coal in the future should not be cheaper than gasoline produced from oil today, just as gasoline produced from coal today would undoubtedly be cheaper than was gasoline produced from oil in the past. If it were necessary, a free American economy could respond to a loss of foreign supplies by turning to such other sources of oil and gasoline as these, and in not very much time, both through reducing their costs of production and by developing other, newer sources of fuel, would enjoy lower costs and more abundant supplies of energy than ever before. In a free American economy, it would not matter in the long run if the Arabian Peninsula and its oil simply did not exist. As a free economy, we would not need Arab oil. Neither our survival nor our long-run progressive prosperity would depend on it. The growing threat to the supply of natural resources that people are beginning to complain about is not the result of anything physical. No more than it was the result of anything physical in the days when these terrible words of despair were written. Quote, "You must know that the world has grown old and does not remain in its former vigor. It bears witness to its own decline. The rainfall and the sun's warmth are both diminishing. The metals are nearly exhausted. The husbandman is failing in the fields, the sailor on the seas, the soldier in the camp, honesty in the market, justice in the courts, concord in friendship, skill in the arts, discipline in morals. This is the sentence passed upon the world, that everything which has a beginning should perish, that things which have reached maturity should grow old, the strong weak, the great small, and that after weakness and shrinkage should come dissolution." That's the limits to growth in spades. That passage is not a quotation from some contemporary ecologist or conservationist. It was written in the 3rd century, ages before the first chunk of coal, drop of oil, ounce of aluminum, or any significant quantity of any mineral whatever had been taken from the earth. The quotation appears, incidentally, in W.T. Jones' The Medieval Mind, Volume 2 of A History of Western Philosophy. Then as now, the problem was not physical, but philosophical and political. Then as now, men were turning away from reason and toward mysticism. Then as now, they were growing less free and falling ever more under the rule of physical force. That is why they believed, and that is why people in our culture are beginning to believe, that man is helpless before physical nature. There is no helplessness in fact. To men who use reason and are free to act, nature gives more and more. To those who turn away from reason or are not free, it gives less and less. Nothing more is involved. There are no significant scarcities of accessible raw materials as yet. But the enemies of reason and capitalism sense the consequences of the social system that they hope to impose, and they project it onto the present. And thus they admonish us to save every little tin can and every scrap of paper. Their world, if it ever comes, will have to live like that. But we, who are capable of producing in abundance, we do not have to regard bits of garbage as priceless treasures. To us, used tin cans, paper wrappings, and the like, which cost us hardly any labor to produce or to replace, are generally not worth the trouble of saving or reusing. In fact, it is usually wasteful for us to do so. It wastes our labor and our time, which are the only things in life we should be concerned about not wasting. For if we can produce new tin cans easily by scooping iron ore out of the earth in 10 or 20 ton loads, it is simply ludicrous to take the trouble to gather up each little tin can and carry it off to some recycling center, because in doing so, we spend far more labor than we save. Nor is it wasteful or uneconomic in any way that we use so many tin cans or so many paper wrappings. If we consider how little labor it costs us in terms of the time it takes to earn the money we spend for it, to have things brought to us clean and fresh and new, in new containers and new packaging, and what the alternatives are for the spending of that money or the use of that time, it becomes clear that the expenditure is well made. Because consider the alternatives. We could have our food and other goods wrapped in old newspapers and put in jars, bags, or boxes that we would have to carry along with us whenever we went shopping, or which we would have to make a special trip to go and fetch whenever we came on something unexpectedly that we wanted to buy. We could then use the money we saved in that way to buy a handful of other goods. Conceivably, we could use the money we saved to work a few minutes less at our jobs each day and earn correspondingly less. But these alternatives would simply be bizarre, because neither a handful of extra goods nor working a few minutes less at our jobs each day would compensate us for the loss of cleanliness, convenience, aesthetic satisfaction, and also time saved in shopping that is provided by modern packaging. Let the ecologists adopt the poverty-stricken lifestyle of Eastern Europe if they choose. Let them go about like old Russian grandmothers in Moscow with an ever-present shopping bag and herring jar, if that is what they like. Let them pick through garbage pails while pretending that they live in a spaceship. Spaceship Earth, they call it, rather than in the richest country of the planet Earth. But there is absolutely no sane reason why anyone should or needs to live this way, and certainly not in modern America. Above all, let them keep their peculiar sense of values to themselves and not seek to impose it on the rest of us by the enactment of laws. And now let us turn to the first of the principles of free market economics that I referred to at the start of tonight's lecture. Namely, the principle that in a free market, there is a tendency toward the establishment of a uniform price for the same good throughout the world. I will repeat this. In a free market, there is a tendency toward the establishment of a uniform price for the same good throughout the world. The basis of this principle is the fact that any inequality in the price of the same good between two markets creates an opportunity for profit. In order to profit, all one need do is buy in the cheaper market and sell in the dearer market. The very fact of doing this, however, acts to reduce the inequality in price. because the additional buying raises the price in the cheaper market, and the additional selling lowers it in the more expensive market. The process tends to continue until the inequality in price between the two markets is totally eliminated and a uniformity of price achieved. The reason that uniform prices among different geographical markets are not actually established is mainly due to the existence of transportation costs. The existence of these costs means that before a price discrepancy between two markets becomes profitable to exploit, it must exceed these transportation costs. These costs, however, then set the limits which geographical price discrepancies do not tend to exceed. Or to put it positively, the price of the same good tends to be uniform throughout the world, except for transportation costs between markets. The significance of this principle is very great. Its operation explains, for example, why local crop failures in a free market do not result even in significant scarcities, let alone in famines. Observe, the effect of a local crop failure is to begin raising the price of grain in the local market. Once the local price of grain exceeds prices in outside markets by more than transportation costs, it becomes profitable to buy in those outside markets and sell locally. The effect is that the reduction in the local supply is almost entirely made good by drawing on the production of the rest of the world. Consequently, instead of a disastrous reduction in the local supply and an enormous rise in the local price, there is a modest reduction in the world supply and a modest rise in the world price of grain. A good analogy to what happens is provided by the physical principle that water seeks its level. Imagine that you have just filled an ice tray, the kind in which water is able to flow around and underneath the plastic insert that marks off the separate compartments for the ice cubes. If you now remove water from one compartment of the tray, you will not reduce the water level in that compartment by the amount of the water you take from it. You will reduce the water level in that compartment and in the whole tray very slightly, because the loss from the one compartment will be spread over the whole tray. In just the same way, if half the wheat crop of France were lost, the supply of wheat in France would not fall by half. On the contrary, the supply in France and in the whole world might fall by 2 or 3%, or however much of a loss the French loss represented of the world supply. Water seeks its level by virtue of the force of pressure. It moves from places of higher pressure to places of lower pressure. Commodity prices seek their level by virtue of the attraction of profits. They move from places of lower prices to places of higher prices, in the process equalizing prices as the movement of water equalizes pressure. Now, I would like to point out that this principle of the tendency toward a geographical uniformity of prices is not only descriptively analogous to a law of physics, but as far as the ability of governments to act is concerned, it has the same existential status as a law of physics. And so, incidentally, do all the principles of economics. That means it is impossible, even for the world's most powerful governments, to annul its operation. Governments can frustrate its operation, but even in the cases in which they do so, they cannot annul its operation. The existence of the principle is confirmed by the very attempts to frustrate it. Because to frustrate it, definite means must be adopted, which are only necessary because the principle exists and is out there working. For example, governments may adopt tariffs, or they may prohibit imports or exports altogether, and in that way stop the equalization of prices. But why must they resort precisely to such measures and not other measures? The answer is because the principle I have named does exist and is at work even in a controlled economy. controls of a specific kind are needed to counter it. There is no difference here between economics and the example of water seeking its level. We can make ice trays in which each compartment is totally insulated from all the others. That does not contradict the principle that water seeks its level. It confirms it, because the insulation is only required because water does seek its level and one wishes to stop it from doing so. It is the same way with all economic laws and government attempts to frustrate them. Now let us apply the principle that in a free market there tends to be a uniform price of the same good throughout the world to the Arab oil embargo of 1973. This principle shows that if the United States had had a free market in oil when the Arabs imposed their embargo, our oil supplies could not have been seriously jeopardized. Think back to the time of the embargo and imagine that everything else is the same except that the United States has a free market in oil. The Arabs now launch their embargo. The immediate effect is that a large part of the oil supplies of the northeastern United States, the major importing region and the one dependent on the Arabs, is cut off. In a free market, no sooner would this have happened than the price of oil and oil products in the Northeast would have begun to rise. Once prices in the Northeast came to exceed those in the rest of the country by more than the costs of transportation, supplies would have moved from the rest of the country to the Northeast. The effect would have been largely to replenish supplies in the Northeast and to reduce supplies somewhat in the rest of the country. The reduction in imports from the Arabs, in other words, would have been spread over the whole country instead of being concentrated in the Northeast, where it threatened to cripple the economy of the region. In this way, its impact would have been minimized. Prices in the Northeast would have been held down by the inflow of new supplies, and those in the rest of the country raised up by the shipments to the Northeast. In fact, the higher level of oil prices in the Northeast and in the country as a whole would have acted as a magnet to supplies of oil from outside the country. Because the same motives that would have impelled a southern or midwestern oil producer to send additional supplies to New York or Boston would also have impelled a Venezuelan producer to do so. In fact, additional imports could have come from the most remote places, because as the rise in prices in the Northeast pulled up prices in the rest of the country, it could very well have become profitable to start shipping additional oil supplies to the West Coast from oil-producing areas like Indonesia, thereby freeing more of domestic production for supplying the Northeast. Indeed, the United States could have gone on, indirectly, importing Arab oil. This would have occurred simply as a result of expanding the import of refined petroleum products made from Arab oil in places not subject to the Arab embargo. For example, if the Arabs continued to supply Spanish refineries, say, and the price of refined products had risen in the United States, those refineries would have diverted more of their output to the United States. It thus becomes apparent that within a fairly short time, an embargo by the Arabs against oil shipments to the United States would have had very little effect on the supply of oil in the United States. To the extent that the United States had been importing Arab oil, it would, for the most part, merely have changed importers. And for much of the rest, it would even have continued to import Arab oil, but by a circuitous route. It would have imported more from places like Venezuela and Indonesia to compensate for the loss of imports from the Arabs, and it would have imported larger quantities of refined petroleum products made from Arab oil instead of Arab crude oil. The reason the Arab embargo did threaten us was the existence of our price controls. When oil supplies to the Northeast were cut off by the embargo, price controls prohibited the people in the Northeast from bidding up oil prices. The people in the Northeast, were therefore made powerless to bring about the shipment of additional supplies from the rest of the country. In the same way, price controls prohibited the people of the United States as a whole from bidding up prices, with the result that it was not possible to bring about stepped-up imports from non-Arab sources. The effect of our price controls was to cause the reduction in imports from the Arabs to be experienced with full force at its initial point of impact and to make it impossible to obtain replacement imports. Our price controls paralyzed us. They made it impossible for us to take the actions needed to deal with the situation. Indeed, because of our price controls, we were not only prevented from finding replacement imports for the loss of Arab imports, but were forced to lose imports from non-Arab sources as well. This happened because other countries in the world, which did not impose price controls, such as West Germany, became better markets in which to sell oil than the United States. As a result, our non-Arab foreign suppliers were led to sell more of their oil in these countries and less to us. Because of our price controls, we tied our hands in the international competition for oil and made it possible for countries far poorer than ourselves to outbid us for oil we had normally consumed. There is more to say about why a free American economy would have had nothing to fear from an Arab embargo. Look back again at late 1973 and early 1974. The Arabs were threatening to cut off oil supplies to the world. There was near panic over whether they would do so. There seemed to be no solution except either to give in to their demands, whatever they might be, or go to war with them. Now, if we had had a free economy, any embargo the Arabs might have launched against the rest of the world would have been economically suicidal for them, and therefore could not have lasted very long, even if it took place at all. The only major effect of such an embargo would have been to strengthen our oil industry at the expense of their oil industry. To understand these points, let us assume that the American economy had been free of all price controls in 1973, and that the Arabs had launched their embargo with the serious intention of cutting off their supply of oil to the world. Let us assume that the worst fears people had at the time came true, and that the Arabs simply stopped selling oil to anyone in an effort to blackmail the world into doing their bidding. The effect, of course, would have been a skyrocketing of the price of oil. But observe, the Arabs wouldn't have gotten the benefit of the higher price because they wouldn't have been selling any oil. The benefit of the higher price would have gone to the non-Arab producers, mainly to the producers in the United States. The American oil companies in that case really would have made fabulous profits. They might have been making profits at a rate fast enough to double their capitals in a single year or less. They would have made the kind of money the Arabs have made. In the face of the Arabs' withdrawal from the market, a tendency would have set in to reestablish the United States as an oil exporter, because Western Europe and Japan would have had to turn to us. However much prices skyrocketed here, they would have skyrocketed still more there. Instead of our high prices pulling oil in, we would have begun to ship oil out in response to their still higher prices. Billions of dollars would have begun to flow from Western Europe and Japan to the United States, not to Iran or Saudi Arabia. With vast profits starting to pour in from the rest of the world, and of course from the American consumer too, huge sums would have become available for every kind of oil and energy project in the United States. It would not have taken long with such profits for the domestic oil industry to have been entirely rejuvenated and established more gloriously than ever before, and who knows what other sources of energy along with it. Now consider the Arabs. While the American oil producers would have been making money hand over fist, the Arabs would have been starving for lack of income. In this context, it would have been virtually certain that the Arab alliance would soon have broken up. The less irrational Arab countries would soon have resumed the sale of oil in order to cash in on the profits. Probably in very short order, all of them would have. So in fact, the supply of oil in the world would almost certainly not have been drastically reduced for very long, even on a temporary basis, despite whatever intentions the Arabs may originally have had. And therefore, the United States would not, in fact, have had to switch for very long, if at all, from the role of an oil importer to the sudden role of an oil exporter. But to whatever extent the Arabs had delayed in resuming the sale of oil, the effect of their action would have been to impoverish themselves while enormously enriching the oil industry in every other country, especially the United States. In the years that followed, the American oil industry would have been bigger and richer. American oil production and the production of other forms of energy in the United States would have been expanded because of the additional profits that American firms had earned. Very possibly, a year or two after the embargo, the price of oil would have fallen below its level in the period before the embargo because of expanded American production. The oil industry at that point might have run at losses for a while. The American firms would have been able to cover their losses out of the profits the Arabs had handed them. The Arabs would not have been able to cover their losses as easily. Consequently, the effect of the whole process would have been a larger American oil industry and quite possibly a smaller Arab oil industry. This is what economic freedom would have accomplished. Now, the question might be raised of just how high prices could have gone during the Arab embargo if we had not had price controls. Frankly, I do not know. Perhaps for a brief period, we might have had dollar a gallon gasoline or even more expensive gasoline. While they lasted, such prices would certainly have represented a hardship for many people, myself included. But by now, we would have had far lower oil prices than we do have. Furthermore, as we will see in later lectures, even while a high price lasts, the real problem is not the high price, but the scarce supply. No one's hardship is alleviated by a low price for goods he cannot buy, which is always the effect of price controls. If we in fact have a scarcity and consumption must be restricted, then, as we will see in later lectures, the high price is necessary and positively beneficial because it leads people to restrict their consumption in the ways that are least damaging to themselves. The policy of price controls on oil during the embargo, therefore, cannot even be said to have sacrificed our long-run economic well-being to our short-run economic well-being. It sacrificed both our long-run and our short-run economic well-being. And now let us turn to the second of the principles of free market economics that I referred to at the start of tonight's lecture, a principle that is very similar to the tendency toward a geographical uniformity of price, but which applies to time rather than space. Namely, the principle that in a free market, there is a tendency toward the equalization of the price of a good in the present with the expected price of that good in the future. In a free market, there is a tendency toward the equalization of the price of a good in the present with the expected price of that good in the future. This principle applies to any good that is capable of being held in storage. For example, there is a tendency for the price of wheat or crude oil or whichever today to be equal to the expected price of wheat or crude oil or whichever next month, 6 months from now, or next year. The basis of this principle is the by now familiar fact that any discrepancy in price creates an opportunity for profit, the exploitation of which reduces the discrepancy. If, for example, wheat is expected to be more expensive 6 months from now than it is today, then speculators begin to buy wheat at today's comparatively low price for the purpose of storing it and later selling it at the comparatively high price that is expected to exist in the future. The effect of their action is to raise the price of wheat in the present and, by enlarging the supply available in the future, reduce the price of wheat in the future. As a result, the present and expected future prices are brought closer together. The present and expected future prices will never actually be equalized for two important reasons. First, there are costs of storing any commodity. And second, since every business must afford the going rate of profit if it is to continue in existence, it is necessary to earn as good a rate of profit in storing commodities as in any other line of business. Consequently, the actual relationship between present and future prices is that they tend to differ by no more than the costs of storage plus an allowance for the going rate of profit on capital invested in storing the commodities. The practical significance of the operation of this principle can be seen in the following example. Assume that the wheat harvest is 1/12 below the size of the average annual harvest. It is therefore necessary to stretch what would normally be an 11-month supply of wheat over 12 months. If the price of wheat did not rise at harvest time, the consumption of wheat and wheat products would go on at the usual rate, requiring a more severe restriction of consumption later on. Imagine that the price did not rise until after 10 months had gone by, during which time consumption had occurred at the usual rate. In that case, 2 months would be left to go until the next harvest, and it would be necessary to stretch the remaining supplies equal to only 1 month's usual consumption over that period. By the rise in price being delayed this long, 1 month's supplies would have to be made to do the work of 2 instead of 11-month supplies doing the work of 12. The rate of consumption would have to be cut in half instead of merely by 1/12. And it is the same in principle, though less in degree, for all shorter periods during which the rate of consumption is excessive. Always, an excessive rate of consumption in the earlier months must be balanced by a more severely restricted rate of consumption in the later months. The existence of speculation on future prices prevents such calamities and minimizes all such imbalances in the rate of consumption. Speculators anticipate the future prices of commodities and buy or sell the commodity in question for the purpose of profiting from every discrepancy between the present price and the prices they expect to exist in the future. In our example, the activity of the commodity speculators would serve to bring about the minimum necessary restriction in the rate of wheat consumption. Because if they see that in the absence of their activity, prices will reach famine levels in the future, or levels reflecting a severe scarcity, or even any level whatever that exceeds the present price by more than the costs of storage and going rate of profit, they begin to buy the commodity in question for the purpose of profiting from the future high price. Their additional buying raises the price of the commodity in the present and thus restricts the rate of its consumption. Later, as the future unfolds, the goods in the hands of the speculators constitute a larger supply and serve to reduce prices in comparison with what they otherwise would have been. The activity of the speculators, therefore, serves to transfer supplies from a period in which they are less urgently needed, as indicated by their lower price, to a period in which they are more urgently needed, as indicated by their higher price. In this way, it brings about the optimum rate of consumption of limited supplies. Speculative activity, of course, is not limited to anticipating just future scarcities. Rather, it seeks in general to balance consumption and production over time by accumulating stocks of commodities and regulating their rate of consumption. If it is anticipated, for example, that a future harvest will be larger than originally forecast, and thus that the price of wheat in the future will be lower than originally expected, the activity of the speculators will bring about a lower price immediately. Because in anticipation of the lower future price, some of them will begin to sell their holdings of the commodity now in order to find a more profitable employment for their capitals. As a result of their sales, the price begins to fall immediately. And as a consequence of the lower price, the rate of consumption in the present is expanded. In this case, the effect of speculative activity is to permit present consumption to expand in the knowledge that larger future production than originally expected necessitates the holding of smaller present stocks. Much, but by no means all, speculative activity is carried on organized commodity exchanges. On these exchanges, it is possible to speculate without oneself having to actually buy and store the physical commodity. It does not pay us to stop to explain the workings of these exchanges beyond saying that in principle they do not differ from what I have described. The effect of their existence is to enable speculation to become a specialized professional activity independent of the accidental circumstance of whether or not one happens to be engaged in the production or processing of the commodities traded and owns warehouses. However, only a relatively small number of basic commodities are traded on the exchanges, principally various agricultural commodities and non-ferrous metals. For the rest, speculation is largely limited to those who are engaged in the actual production or use of the commodity. It should be noted that every businessman is a commodity speculator when he decides what size inventory to hold and whether it is a good time to increase or decrease the size of his inventory. For he is basing his decision on a comparison of present prices and the prices he expects to exist in the future. In the same way, every consumer engages in commodity speculation when he decides to buy more or less than his normal requirements on the basis of a comparison of present prices with the prices he anticipates in the future. The speculative activities of businessmen and consumers serve to equalize present and future prices in additional ways than the ones we have considered. For example, if in anticipation of higher prices, businessmen simply hold back on selling their inventories, they are decreasing the supply available in the present and increasing the supply available in the future, which of course acts to narrow the discrepancy in price. By the same token, if consumers step up their purchases in the present in anticipation of higher prices in the future, then to that extent, their demand for the item in the future will be less because it will have already been provided for. Like almost every economic activity, commodity speculation is frequently denounced. Because speculation transmits the higher prices expected to exist in the future to the present, it is denounced as the cause of the higher prices. What is overlooked in this accusation is that the supplies accumulated as a result of speculation must ultimately be used, and at that time they necessarily act to reduce prices, because either they are put on the market and sold, thereby increasing the supply of the commodity, or by sparing their owners the need to purchase, they reduce the demand for the commodity. Moreover, if the speculators are mistaken, if they raise the present price and there is no independent cause of a higher price in the future, they pay the penalty of their mistake. because they have bought at high prices and must sell at low prices, or they have stocked up at high prices when they might later have bought at low prices. Let us apply our knowledge of speculation to the charge that the oil shortage of late 1973 and early 1974 was, quote, manufactured by the oil companies. This claim was repeated over and over again in the press and on television at the time. The proof offered that the oil companies were artificially creating the oil shortage was the fact that their storage depots were full of oil. I remember one television news story filmed at an oil company tank farm in which the reporter pointed to the tanks, said he had personally seen that they were full, and therefore that there could be no real shortage of oil, but just an artificial one created by the oil companies. The reporter, his editor, station, and network evidently forgot or did not know the major news item of the time, which was the prospect that in the coming months, the United States would be deprived of a significant part of its customary imports of oil while having to meet the possibility of a long, severe winter. The tanks and storage depots were full in anticipation of that terrible prospect. The fullness of the tanks and depots was not, as the press claimed, a proof of the abundance of oil, but of its prospective scarcity. To understand the significance of the full tank farms and storage depots, imagine what it would take to make you think it necessary to fill every spare inch of your kitchen with food. The fullness of your kitchen would not be proof of the abundance of food, but of your anticipation of its prospective scarcity. What the oil companies did to build up their reserves was to withhold oil from current consumption. Given the fact that price controls were in force, and thus that the price of oil was not allowed to rise, the reduction in the supply of oil offered for sale did intensify the shortage of the moment, but in order to avert the possibility of a far more serious shortage later on, a shortage in which people might be freezing to death. Please observe that if we had not had price controls, the oil company's buildup of stocks would not have caused a shortage of oil, even though it reduced the supply currently available. In the absence of price controls, the buildup would have raised the current price of oil. And at higher prices, people would have economized on their use of oil products to whatever extent it was necessary to reduce current consumption. Of course, higher prices would also have pulled in supplies from other markets, making the necessary reduction in current consumption that much less. As we will see in later lectures, anyone able and willing to pay the higher current prices would have been able to buy whatever oil products he wished. There would have been no shortage in the sense of people being able and willing to pay the asking price of oil, but unable to obtain it. But as I say, in the context of price controls, reductions in the supply of oil currently available simply intensified the shortage, because no restriction of demand or drawing in of outside supplies could occur. Therefore, while the action of the oil companies in building up stocks of oil did reduce the supply currently available, it did not create the shortage. The shortage, in the sense of people able and willing to pay the prices asked, but not being able to find supplies, was the result of price controls. Now, as a final point, I must say that it is probable that price controls led the oil companies to build up reserves even beyond the need to provide for future consumption. This had to be the case to whatever extent the oil companies came to expect the controls either to be repealed in the near future or at least raised. To the extent the oil companies had this expectation, the controls served to discriminate against current sales in favor of future sales, they made it profitable to postpone sales and provide even more fully for the future. In this way, too, the controls caused the shortage. In sum, it is only correct to say the oil shortage was, quote, manufactured and artificial, if one realizes that it was manufactured by the government through price controls, not by the oil companies and their perfectly natural desire to earn profits. I'll have more to say about this subject in later lectures. The next principle of economics I want to turn to, which is very similar both to the uniformity of profit principle and the uniformity of price principles that we discussed in the first half of the lecture, is the fact that in a free market, there is a tendency toward an equalization of wage rates for labor of the same degree of ability. In a free market, there is a tendency toward an equalization of wage rates for labor of the same degree of ability. I must stress the words same degree of ability because there is an equally powerful and corollary tendency toward unequal wage rates for labor of different degrees of ability, as we will also see. The basis of this tendency toward equality is the fact that men prefer to earn a higher income rather than a lower income, and therefore seek higher paying jobs in preference to lower paying jobs. The movement of labor into the higher paying fields and out of the lower paying fields reduces wage rates in the higher paying fields and raises them in the lower paying fields. The stopping point is an equality of wage rates. This is not to say that 40 or 50-year-old workers suddenly give up their work of many years and change to a brand new occupation in response to a 5 or 10 or even 20% difference in wages. No. In view of the costs such workers would have to incur in terms of paying for the learning of new skills comparable to those they already possess in their present work, it would not pay them to switch occupations except in cases of really major differences in wages, brought about, for example, by their previous jobs being rendered obsolete through technological progress. The movement of labor from occupation to occupation in response to less than gross differences in wages is accomplished in a different way. It is accomplished by virtue of the fact that each occupation continuously loses members through death or retirement and must continuously be resupplied with young workers. Changes in the flow of young workers into the various occupations produce the same effect as an actual movement of labor between occupations. Because where the number of young workers entering an occupation exceeds the number of old workers dying or retiring, the supply of labor in that occupation rises. Where the number of young workers entering an occupation is less than the number of old workers leaving, the supply of labor in that occupation falls. Now, by the time young people are ready to begin preparing themselves for a career, there are very marked differences in their ability and willingness to learn. And for this reason, the labor force necessarily assumes a hierarchical structure, with the tendency toward an equalization of wage rates being operative only within the respective levels of this structure and not throughout the structure as a whole. Those with the greatest ability and willingness to learn are potentially capable of performing practically any job. For example, the young man who is capable of learning to be a surgeon is also certainly capable of learning to be a printer. In turn, the young man whose learning ability does not go beyond that of being able to learn to be a printer is also certainly capable of learning to work on an assembly line. Everyone, in other words, the potential surgeon, the potential printer, and the potential assembly line worker, is capable of doing the work of the assembly line worker. But only the surgeon and printer are capable of doing the work of the printer. and only the surgeon alone is capable of doing the work of the surgeon. In conformity with the principle contained in this example, let us think of the young people ready to prepare for a career as divided into three broad groups: those capable of entering the professions, those capable of learning to do skilled work, and those capable of learning no more than low-skilled work. Now, this division of the potential labor force necessarily prevents any tendency toward a general equalization of wage rates. Because no matter how high the wage rates of the professions may climb in relation to those of skilled and unskilled labor, it is simply impossible for young people who lack the necessary capacity to go into the professions instead of skilled or unskilled labor. Similarly, no matter how high the wages of skilled labor may climb in relation to those of unskilled labor, there is again no way for the young people who lack the necessary capacity to enter the field of skilled labor instead of unskilled labor. But observe, the wages of skilled labor are limited in relation to those of professional labor. Because as soon as the wages of skilled labor begin to exceed those of professional labor, it is possible for young people capable of the professions to enter the field of skilled labor. In the same way, the wages of unskilled labor are limited in relation to those of skilled labor, because as soon as the wages of unskilled labor begin to exceed those of skilled labor, it is possible for young people capable of skilled labor to enter the field of unskilled labor. It is because of this hierarchical division of the total pool of human talent, of the fact that ability can flow downward to lower channels, but not upward to higher channels, so to speak, that we observe in actual life that the wages of professional labor markedly and permanently exceed those of skilled labor, while those of skilled labor, in turn, markedly and permanently exceed those of unskilled labor. And we observe that the wages of the highest paid parts of skilled labor cannot get very far above the wages of the lowest paid parts of professional labor, nor the wages of the highest paid parts of unskilled labor very far ahead of the wages of the lowest paid parts of skilled labor. This explains inequalities in wages. Let us return to the question of why wages within any given level of ability tend to be equal. Let us consider the wage rates of a number of fairly skilled occupations. For example, the various building trades, such as carpenters, electricians, and plumbers, and other occupations, such as printers, draftsmen, mechanics, computer programmers, and locomotive engineers. All of these occupations and others of a similar nature require the same basic level of intelligence and education on the part of the workers. As a result, they are all potentially capable of being performed by the same people. All of them, in effect, can be supplied with labor that is drawn from a pool of human talent all on the same basic level. And because of men's preference for a higher income over a lower income, this pool of talent will naturally run more heavily into those occupations which offer higher wages and less heavily into those which offer lower wages. As a result, there will be a tendency toward an increase in the supply of labor in the better paying kinds of skilled work and a decrease in the supply of labor in the poorer paying kinds of skilled work. Since the effect of the increases in the supply of labor in the initially higher paying fields is to reduce wages in those fields, while the effect of the decrease in the supply of labor in the initially lower paying fields is to raise wages in those fields, the discrepancy in the wages among the different kinds of skilled labor is narrowed, and thus they tend toward equality. In exactly the same way, there is a tendency toward a uniformity of wages among the various unskilled or low-skilled occupations, such as assembly line workers, machine tenders, truck and bus drivers, clerks, stevedores, and so on. And there is a tendency toward a further uniformity of wage rates among the various professions, such as doctors, lawyers, scientists, engineers, professors, and so on. because in these cases too, the original pool of talent flows into the various channels on its level in accordance with the wages to be made, and in flowing more or less heavily, lowers or raises those wages, thereby reducing the discrepancies among them and driving them toward equality. There are, of course, in reality, important differences in wages of a permanent nature, even within the three broad groups of workers that I have delineated. At each level, there is a tendency for some particular occupations to earn more than others. For example, for doctors to earn more than professors, and for stevedores to earn more than clerks. There are also important differences in earnings within each occupation, especially at the professional level. For example, there are always some doctors or lawyers who earn 5 or 10 times as much as the average of their profession. And there are some printers or mechanics who earn significantly more than others. These differences are due in part to the existence of further categories of division in human ability. There are those who have the ability and willingness to learn how to be a doctor or lawyer, and others who have the ability and willingness to learn how to be a great doctor or lawyer. In other cases, willingness and ability to learn is not the sole criterion of division. Other factors have to be added. For example, in many types of work, especially unskilled work, it is necessary to possess a significant degree of physical strength. Those who have it are in a narrower category than those who do not, and accordingly tend to be higher paid. In other cases, workers are differentiated by the special development of other physical or psychological potentials, such as muscular coordination, an ear for music, special visual acuity, and so on. In the case of great athletes, opera singers, musicians, and actors, all the really star performers, the combination of special characteristics is such as to make the labor of these persons virtually unique. And when they are in demand, their earnings do not have any fixed limit because no one is able to increase the supply of what they are offering. For the rest, the differences in wages within the various broad groups are the result of the fact that considerations other than money are associated with each job. There are such considerations as how interesting or uninteresting is the work, how pleasant or unpleasant are the conditions of the work, how safe or dangerous is it, how regular is the employment, how long and how expensive is the special preparation required, and perhaps still other similar considerations. Considerations of this kind explain, for example, why scientists tend to earn less and, say, tax accountants more than is commensurate with their respective levels of ability. In the one case, the work itself may be the highest pleasure in life to those who perform it. In the other, it is more likely to be experienced as painfully dull. As a result, those with the necessary ability to be scientists are willing to enter the field even to the point of accepting substantially lower wages in comparison with what they could earn elsewhere. By the same token, people would cease to enter such a field as tax law as soon as that field, or tax accounting, as soon as that field no longer offered a significant monetary advantage over other fields they might enter. The principle that emerges here is that any occupation which offers special non-monetary advantages tends to offer correspondingly lower wages, while any occupation that imposes special disadvantages of any kind tends to offer correspondingly higher wages. These discounts and premiums in wages balance the special advantages and disadvantages of the various occupations. In summarizing this discussion of wages, we must say that in a free market, there are at least three principles of wage determination at work simultaneously. One is a tendency toward a uniformity of wages for the same degree of ability. A second is a tendency toward the inclusion of premiums or discounts in those wages as an offsetting element to special disadvantages or advantages. And the third is a tendency toward unequal wage rates for labor of different degrees of ability. primarily intellectual ability, but also other abilities as well. The combined operation of these three principles helps to explain the full range of the various wage rates we observe in actual life. Now, as far as it operates, the principle of the uniformity of wage rates is similar in its consequences to the uniformity of profit principle. That is, it serves to keep the various occupations supplied with labor in the proper proportions. Too many people do not rush into carpentering and not enough into printing, say, because the very effect of such a mistake is to reduce the wages of carpenters and raise those of printers. This acts to delimit and counteract the mistake. In addition, the operation of this principle gives to consumers the ultimate power to determine the relative size of the various occupations. If the consumers buy more books and less products made of wood, to stay with that example, then the effect of the change in their buying pattern causes the demand for printers to rise and that for carpenters to fall. As a result, the wages of printers rise and more young men are induced to become printers, while the wages of carpenters fall and fewer young men become carpenters. Please observe, as this example of the printers shows, that in seeking to earn the highest wages he can, the individual worker is seeking to do the kind of work the consumers most want him to do. This is true of every individual who seeks to take the best paying job he can find at any given level of ability, or who seeks to raise his level of ability. Because what enables any job to pay more is only the fact that the consumers want its products sufficiently. Let them decide to reduce their demand for its products, and the wages it pays will tend to fall. While if they raise their demand for its products, the wages it pays will tend to rise. In a free market, within the limit of his abilities, each man chooses that job which, he believes, offers him the best combination of money and non-monetary considerations. In so doing, he simultaneously acts for his own maximum well-being and for that of the consumers who buy the ultimate products his labor produces. The final principle of economics that I want to discuss tonight is the fact that in a free market, the prices of products tend to be governed by their costs of production. In a free market, the prices of products tend to be governed by their costs of production. This principle follows directly from the uniformity of profit principle, and we have already glimpsed it in Lecture 3 in discussing the long-run consequences of repealing price controls. The uniformity of profit principle implies that the prices of products tend to equal their costs of production, plus only so much profit as is required to afford the going rate of profit on the capital invested. If prices exceed costs by more than this amount of profit, then there is a tendency toward expanded production and lower prices. If they fail to exceed costs by as much as this amount of profit, then there is a tendency toward reduced production and higher prices. The stopping point is, as I say, where prices equal costs of production plus the amount of profit required to yield the going rate of profit on the capital invested. Now, there are two ways that cost of production governs prices. One way is indirectly through variations in the supply of the good produced. The other way is directly, through the decisions of the sellers of the good in setting their prices. Let us consider first the cases in which the role of cost is indirect, for example, all or most agricultural commodities. In any given year, the price of wheat or potatoes or cotton or whichever is determined simply by supply and demand. Over a period of years, however, the price of such a good tends to gravitate about its cost of production. We have already seen why. That is because whenever the price begins to exceed cost by more than is required to afford the average rate of profit to the industry, additional capital will be invested, supply will be expanded, and the price and profit will decline. If the price fails to provide the average rate of profit to the industry, capital will be withdrawn, supply will be reduced, and the price and profit will be restored. Observe that what ties price to cost in such a case is simply variations in supply. However, there is a vast category of cases in which the connection between price and cost is far more direct. This is the case of most manufactured or processed goods. In these cases, the sellers typically maintain inventories of their goods and have plant capacity available to produce more. In such a situation, a rise in demand, provided it is not too large, is met out of inventories, and before the inventory is exhausted, production is stepped up from plant capacity held in reserve. Similarly, when a fall in demand occurs, inventory is temporarily allowed to build up and production is cut back. Provided the changes in demand are not of major proportions, there is little or no change in price. Observe, for example, that the price of bread, automobiles, newspapers, restaurant meals, paper clips, and countless other goods does not change with every change in demand. A change in demand must be fairly substantial to raise or lower the price of these goods.